The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, June the 6th, 2025. It is 9:57 a.m. here in the UK, making it coming up to, 3 minutes to midday over in South Africa, where, 3 minutes to 11, I believe, where my good friend Dr. Peter Hammond is. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I'm with you, yes. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, I'm going to do something quickly because we're going to cover something today that is in the news at the moment but is changing. So I gave you the timestamp and the date, and now I'm going to give you four. These are all the top stories on the websites I'm going to go to. So the first one, Associated Press, apnews.com. Live updates, Trump ceasefire falters as Israel says Iran launch more missiles. Then from Reuters.com, Israel says Iran violates ceasefire, orders new strikes. From the BBC News website, live feed, Israel Defense Minister accuses Iran of violating ceasefire and orders powerful strikes on Tehran. And finally, from the Daily Mail, live, Trump's Middle East ceasefire breaks down almost immediately as Iran fires missiles and Israel vows to respond forcefully after US President pleaded both sides not to violate agreement. So that's where we are right now for Peter's presentation today, entitled The Real Story Behind the War Between Israel and Iran. So, Peter, where would you like to start us off today?
Well, the Bible does tell us in Proverbs 20, verse 3, it's honorable for man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel. And we are told, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. And Romans 12, 18 says, if it be possible, inasmuch as lies within you, live peaceably with all men. And this is important, that we try not to be warmongers, but we try to be peacemakers. And so we must continue to be in prayer for the situation, because any conflict in the Middle East can spiral out of control very quickly. If, for example, it becomes nuclear, we've already had Pakistan say that if Israel uses a nuclear bomb on Iran, Pakistan will throw a nuke on top of Tel Aviv. So you've already got potential expansion. The whole Muslim world will stand by another Muslim country if it's under attack by a Western force, particularly if that includes the State of Israel, which is seen as anathema to so many Arab and Muslim countries in the Middle East. So what we are facing is a potentially catastrophic conflict, which could affect a lot of people very quickly, especially considering the fact that Iran has some kind of alliance with Russia. We're not sure how far that would go, but they are also part of the BRICS grouping of economic states. And so Iran and Russia have some kind of alliance, and who knows where that could go if the war sucks America in. And there's been a lot of Americans speaking out against Donald Trump getting America involved in this conflict. But I think what people need to understand is the story behind it. Why is Iran such a hostile partner, such a hostile country against the Western nations in particular? And if you speak to the Iranians, they'll say, because the United States supports the state of Israel, which they see themselves as a rogue state that has been causing wars in the Middle East. But there's a bigger story than that behind it all, because during the Second World War, Iran was a neutral country, but it was first invaded by Great Britain and then by the United States in order to make a conduit, a safe passage for the lend-lease vast amounts of American weaponry, what they called the Arsenal for Democracy, being shipped through to Stalin's Soviet Union, which of course was anything but a democracy and was probably the worst totalitarian state on earth, if not the worst in history. And yet Britain and America invaded two neutral countries to supply the Soviet Union. They invaded Iceland and they invaded Iran in order to channel huge amounts of weaponry, as in the thousands of tons in the multiplied billions of dollars worth of tanks and bomber aircraft and fighter aircraft and tens of millions of artillery shells and billions of rounds of ammunition and vast amounts of cloth and cotton and food. And you could not imagine how much was sent through under Lend-Lease in the multiplied hundreds of billions of dollars worth to save Stalin's Soviet Union from destruction. So the Iranians know what it's like to have their neutrality violated for the greater good. In this case, the greater good being the saving of the worst totalitarian dictatorship on earth, the Soviet Union, under the biggest mass murderer of all time, Joseph Stalin. But that's not the end of the story. Back in the 1950s, there was a joint British MI6 American CIA operation to topple the elected government in Iran, what used to be called Persia, in order to install a leader that was more acceptable to the oil companies that were, of course, benefiting from the vast oil reserves of Iran. I believe Iran's got some of the biggest oil reserves on earth. And that's not the end of it, because in 1979, the U.S. State Department under Jimmy Carter played a key role in subverting the government of the Shah of Iran and overthrowing Iran as a peaceful, pro-Western, stable country, handing them over to Ayatollah crazies, first Ayatollah Khomeini. And people should remember that the Shah of Iran provided one of the most advanced, sophisticated, and growing economies in the Middle East and a stable ally for the West. It was a very positive influence in the Middle East. And the stable country of Iran under the Shah was betrayed by Jimmy Carter's foreign policy. And they played a pivotal role in supporting the Ayatollah Khomeini's crazies who now have control of the country. And the alliance of 37 years between the United States of America and the Shah of Iran was undermined by Jimmy Carter and his advisors, quote unquote, deceitful and misguided policies. And the Shah had started in 1963 a major modernizing, westernizing policy, which had brought Iran into the 20th century and taken him on a tremendous growth spurt. And if you look at pictures of Iran and Tehran back in the 1970s, you'll see a very modern country that almost looks like Western Europe in so many ways, the fashions, the behavior of the people and so on. And yet now all the women are wrapped up in these black hijabs, walking around these mobile tents and so on, and getting whipped if they dare show one follicle of hair out from under their scarves and the hijabs and so on. And anyone who might have seen the film or read the book Not Without My Daughter will have some idea on how radical this regime became. But bear in mind that it was Jimmy Carter who pressurized the Shah by supplying the opposition forces in Iran and sent Jinnah, was a pro-Mossadegh sympathizer, and the United States backed the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, which led to his downfall and plunged Iran into chaos, which President Ronald Reagan called an historic stain on American history. And all the while, Jimmy Carter's administration chastised the Shah about human rights issues, while the Shah was fighting for his life against radical Islamicist jihadist forces. And the Shah later said his greatest mistake ever was following American advice, which led to the release of murderous terrorists who were later orchestrating more violence. And on top of this, Jimmy Carter's mistreatment of the Shah of Iran during his illness with lymphatic cancer was also described as inhumane. When he went into exile on the 16th of January, 1979, the Shah was shuttled from country to country, only being allowed into the United States for medical treatment for a very short space of time, and succumbing to his illness, he died in Egypt on the 27th of July, 1980. We don't know what causes cancer, but we do know that stress greatly aggravates it and accelerates it. Well, Jimmy Carter's so-called incoherent and vacillating actions and policies, and not only by the presidency, but his administration, his State Department, his intelligence services, during the Iran crisis, prompted the Shah to ask, why is the CIA so intensely active against me? And the upheaval in Iran raised the question, why did the CIA fail to predict the rise of the Mullahs and the 1979 turmoil, which included the hostage crisis where the U.S. embassy was seized? And America's had a very bad history with Iran. And sadly, the crisis today, when people speak about this rogue regime and so on, and you can't trust Iran with a nuclear weapon, well, that's entirely to blame on American presidents like Jimmy Carter and the U.S. State Department that created this crisis. They, during this 4 years of Jimmy Carter's presidency, 13 countries were betrayed to communism, including Nicaragua and Rhodesia, Rhodesia being where I grew up. And so the support of Jimmy Carter's government for some of the worst governments on earth, like the Soviet Union, is incomprehensible when he spoke about the need for human rights being the governing criteria in all American foreign policy. And yet, as Ronald Reagan pointed out, the hypocrisy of Jimmy Carter's administration in that they supplied huge amounts of weaponry and aid and food to the Soviet Union, which had no human rights, was probably the worst human rights abuser on earth, while sanctioning and targeting countries like Rhodesia, who were defending themselves against communist aggression, were fighting for their lives. So Jimmy Carter was a colossal hypocrite. And we did a whole expose on Jimmy Carter's catastrophic legacy, which led to tremendous increase of persecution of the Christian church. But Jimmy Carter did much more than betraying Iran. He also gave away the Panama Canal, which America had built and paid for multiple times over. He did covert support for the genocide in East Timor, supporting the Indonesian invasion and supplying a lot of the weaponry needed for the incendiary bombing campaigns in the interior of East Timor. So ideas have consequences. Also, Jimmy Carter did bring in the National Department of Education, which was catastrophic and brought America the worst results ever. So the 1979 creating Department of Education was catastrophic for the education of American children, well documented by Alex Newman in his book Indoctrinating Our Children to Death, which is an excellent book on the complete failure of the Department of Education in the United States in particular, and how at the end of that Department of Education's legacy, it had the worst educated, had the lowest results on every academic standard you could care to use in the entire Western world. So the background to the Iran conflict is to bear in mind that the very regime in Iran is there because of the foreign policy of Jimmy Carter, U.S. State Department involvement, the CIA's betrayals. Iran has been invaded, betrayed, toppled. They've suffered a regime change a couple of times before as a result of U.S. foreign policy. And so if people want to condemn Iran as being a rogue state, bear in mind who actually put it there in the first place. It would have been better to have left Iran alone. They were doing much better under the Shah of Iran than they've been doing ever since. And so it's a horrible legacy, and it's got to be pinned to the legacy of Jimmy Carter. Interesting that in the United States of America, it seems that when an American gets elected president, and especially when they die, they enter a pantheon of gods, sort of like the old Roman statism where you worship the state. And it seems that the moment an American president dies, he has got to be praised as a wonderful person and that his political legacy is all good and so on. And it's absolutely bizarre. It's like when you go in the Mall of America and you go all the way down from the White House down to Lincoln Memorial. And there in marble, in this colossal temple, this very imposing temple, you read carved in the walls, in this temple, as in the hearts of a people for whom he saved the Union, Abraham Lincoln will live forever. I mean, this is religious terminology. This is idolatry. And yet it is a temple. And, you know, to speak about a politician having saved his country and that he lives forever and that he's in the hearts of his people, this is not historic or memorial talk. This is not political talk. This is idolatrous religious terminology. And it's incredible how many people who should know better were praising Jimmy Carter, that he's a champion of peace, human rights, and justice. Really, look at Zimbabwe, look at Iran, to see at what peace, human rights, and justice came out of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy. He globalized the human rights movement, and so many people lifting him up as a great hero. But as Jonas Savimbi, our friend and leader of the Freedom Fighter movement in Angola, the leader of UNITA, Jonas Savimbi said during Jimmy Carter's legacy, it is better to be America's enemy than to be America's friend. If you're America's enemy, you'll probably be bought. If you're America's friend, you will certainly be sold. And Jonas Savimbi spoke from personal experience. The pro-Christian Angolans were certainly betrayed by Jimmy Carter's State Department and the CIA. And we need to bear in mind that this is the background, this is the reality to what's going on in Iran. So if the United States speaks about saving the world from Iran or saving the Middle East from being engulfed in some kind of nuclear holocaust because of Iran, well, who brought us there? Who destabilized the stable government of Iran under the Shah and betrayed it in the hands of the Ayatollah Khomeini Shiite jihadists? And if we could just get the Western governments to stop interfering in the Middle East. The British government has a very bad track record in the Middle East as well, and particularly betraying the Kurds, who weren't given their own country but were carved up under the Turks, under the Syrians, under the Iraqis and the Iranians. And Kurdistan should be its own country, but the Kurdish people were denied their right to have self-determination under the First Lord of the Admiralty, but at that stage, Winston Churchill was secretary for the colonies, and he's the one who drew the map to carve Kuwait out as a separate country from Iraq, because there was so much oil in Kuwait, and to put the Kurds under the Turks, the Iraqis, the Iranians, and the Syrians, and then had Kurds bombed with gas by Sopwith camels because they did not like the arrangements and didn't like the taxes that they were getting hit with. So a country that has invaded another country when it was neutral should not be talking about human rights abuses. But when you think how both Britain and America worked to destabilize Iran in the past, I think they should be a little bit more humble in their estimation of what's going on right now. But it does look like the State of Israel started a fight that they could not finish. And the surprise attack of the Israeli Defense Force going and bombing nuclear facilities within Iran. Interesting how the world media generally called it a preemptive strike. Now, interesting, when Russia went into Ukraine, it was unprovoked aggression. But when Israel attacks a country without warning, something like a Pearl Harbor type, invasion of Poland in 1939 was unprovoked aggression. But Israel's bombing of Iran was preemptive strike. Interesting. Germany invading the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa in 1941, was not a preemptive strike, despite all the millions of Soviet forces right at the border, pre-positioned, ready to strike into Europe. That's not a preemptive strike. That's unprovoked aggression, and it's treachery. And when the Japanese react to American provocations and sanctions and oil blockades and so on, even when the Americans had broken the code, the Japanese purple code, the naval code, were well aware of all the intentions, were well aware of the impending strike on Pearl Harbor, but didn't bother to inform their commanders on the ground, on the location. And then spoke about a day that lived in infamy. We had no idea this was coming, and what a surprise. Even when their naval intelligence had cracked the code, they knew about the declaration of war that was coming, and even delayed the Japanese ambassador outside the state Secretary of State's office for the required hour, so that by the time he presents his declaration of war, Hawaii was already being bombed. But that's a day that lived in infamy, because that is that's unprovoked aggression. And even though American State Department officials have since let it be known that they knew it was coming, they hoped the attack was coming. And while the attack was a little bit heavier than they had hoped for, it was still exactly what President Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted: justification to get involved in the war and justify the illegal lend-lease policies, where America was providing multiplied hundreds of tons of high-tech weaponry to the Soviet Union against the laws of America, which had been passed in the 1920s to prevent America ever getting involved in another one of Europe's wars. Remember, America's founding president, George Washington, had counseled, avoid entangling alliances and never get involved in Europe's wars. And that's exactly what Woodrow Wilson had gotten America involved in. And in the absolute revulsion against this war that cost over 115,000 American lives for absolutely nothing, and this war to end all wars and this war for democracy turned out to be only a pretext for a colossal theft of millions of acres of territory all over the world, added to the French and the British empires, and the blatant treachery and theft of the Versailles Treaty. The American people voted the Democrats out of the House, out of the Senate, and out of the White House. And there was a cross-the-board massive landslide in 1920 elections, where Democrats were voted out, seen as the party of war and warmongers and treachery. And in came the Republicans, who enacted extremely strict laws to prevent America ever again helping belligerents, supplying weapons to a belligerent in a war, or getting involved in any entangling alliances, repudiated the League of Nations, and all the rest of it. And that's why what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was doing in supplying weapons to not only Britain, but also to the Soviet Union, was well before Pearl Harbor, was considered not just treacherous, but illegal. And it was jail time crime. So the United States presidency was involved in provoking a war with Japan. They first tried to provoke a war with Germany, with the U.S. Navy literally opening fire on German naval vessels and seeking to provoke reaction. But the Kriegsmarine had been given strict orders not to respond to any American provocation. And therefore, they switched their tactics to, well, we'll have to start the war with Japan then. And then the war with Japan was provoked by total oil boycotts and all other kinds of strategic minerals which were essential for Japan. And Japan was locked in a war against the communist forces in China at that time. And with Japan being the biggest opponent of communism in the East, and Germany being the biggest opponent of communism in the West, interesting that America got itself involved in helping the Soviet Union to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And if you translate into modern day money, it would be in the trillions. But just at that time, it was in hundreds of billions. And they also provided tens of thousands of tanks and hundreds of thousands of vehicles, trucks and jeeps and other vehicles, motorbikes and so on, billions of rounds of ammunition, tens of millions of artillery shells, huge amounts of steel and food and cloths and uniforms and buttons and boots and huge amounts of oil tankers. It was staggering what was done. And of course, Iran was a key part where most of the aid for the Soviet Union went through. And so when we understand these backgrounds, it does make you highly skeptical when suddenly you see people speaking about unprovoked aggression and preemptive strike. So it seems if America does something or if Israel does something, it's a preemptive strike. But if Russia or Germany or any other country or Japan does something, it is considered unprovoked aggression. And so you can just see this inconsistency in the use of language, and it's really the terminology of propaganda. And we do need to understand that. So right now, we need to understand about Iran. Iran is a very important country in the Middle East. Iran is a country that was stable, but has been destabilized and betrayed in the hands of a very violent and difficult and aggressive regime. And I'm very concerned for the Christians. There are millions of Christians in Iran. I don't know if our listeners are aware, but there's a people movement. There's been a move to Christianity in the last 40 years in Iran. Many people in Iran are repelled and disgusted, shocked by the extremism and the violence of the Iranian government, the Ayatollahs, and they've been impressed by the courage and the tenacity of the Christians, and especially the young people. We've seen millions coming to Christ, and Iran has a strong Christian minority who are growing there, heavily persecuted, but it doesn't stop them growing. And I'm concerned about those Christians who don't seem to understand Iran and how many millions of people are there. It's a country of about 90 million people. And Tehran has 7 million people, by the way. And so to hear some people talking about, we need to nuke Tehran, you know, really kill 7 million people? Why? And I've even heard some people, while I was in the United States on a ministry tour just recently, there was a Republican congressman in Florida who said that America should nuke Gaza. Now, for irresponsible, ridiculous statements, that really takes the cake. First of all, has anyone seen a picture of Gaza lately? It's one big wrecking zone pile of rubble. It's been so destroyed through conventional weapons. What is there left to nuke? And why would you nuke a bunch of refugees struggling to survive and eke out a living in a pile of rubble, which is, for all intents and purposes, destroyed? So you've got this kind of mindless nonsense. And then you have a congressman like Ted Cruz, who said recently on a Tucker Carlson interview that his number one reason for supporting Israel is the Bible commands us to support Israel. And so Tucker Carlson asked the logical question, where does the Bible command that? And Ted Cruz couldn't identify where exactly in the Bible, but he says, we must bless Israel. Those who bless Israel will be blessed. Those who curse Israel will be cursed. But as Tucker Carlson said, does it say that? And actually it doesn't. Interestingly, Tucker Carlson helped out Ted Cruz by saying, you find that verse in Genesis, which it seems that Ted Cruz, while he wants unquestioning, unrestricted support for the state of Israel, he couldn't identify where the passage in the Bible was. He couldn't quote the verse properly, which says, to Abraham, those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse, which in Galatians 3:14 is interpreted in the New Testament as to Abraham and to his seed, not to seeds as to many, but to one seed, which is Christ. The New Testament makes it clear that the Genesis promise to bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you was made to Abraham and to his seed, which is Christ. And so this is a messianic prophecy. This is not a blank check or rubber stamp to any political entity. And Tucker Carlson wisely asked Ted Cruz, really, the Bible tells you that you must support the Israeli government? And Ted Cruz reorientates and says, no, you must support the nation. Well, where does it say that? And so Tucker Carlson again asked Ted Cruz, are we talking about the nation in the time when that verse in the Bible was made? Is that the same as the nation that is in Israel today? And of course, the correct answer is no. Although Ted Cruz says, yes, it's exactly the same. But that isn't true. Now, I did a whole study of every book in the Bible. I studied through every book in the Bible. It was a six-year project and preached through it, producing a single sermon, which is on sermon audio, for every single book in the Bible from Genesis through to Revelation. And I adapted these as articles for Joy Magazine and Yoch Tijdschrift, two popular Christian magazines in South Africa, and then they later became chapters in the books Old Testament Survey, New Testament Survey. I can tell you nowhere, not one single prophet ever gave Israel a blank check. Every single prophet in the Old Testament condemned both Judah in the south and Israel, the kingdom in the north. And there's not one that gave a blank check to them. In fact, just to emphasize the point, God abandoned Jerusalem twice and the temple was destroyed twice. And of course, the first being the forces of Babylon from Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed Israel and looted the temple in about 588 BC. And then, of course, in AD 70, you had the temple destroyed and Jerusalem destroyed very decisively under Titus of the Romans invading. And so God didn't give the state of Israel, even when it was a theocratic, God-orientated country, a blank check. Every prophet condemned Judah and Israel for idolatry, for immorality, for interfaith, for ingratitude. Over and over again, you can see the condemnations coming through in every single book of the Old Testament. Every single prophet, without exception, condemned idolatry and immorality. Are we to believe that God, who gave a conditional promise, especially in Deuteronomy 28, if you obey me, you will be blessed. If you disobey me, you will be cursed. And all the promises that were given, Leviticus 26, Jeremiah 18, in the Bible, that these conditional promises, promises of blessing for obedience and promises of cursing for disobedience, that somehow in the New Testament era, the secular state of Israel, founded in 1948, gets an unconditional blank check, and every Christian on earth must support the state, even though they are a secular state, even though most of the people are effectively atheists, and they've got legalized abortion, legalized pornography, legalized LGBTQ perversion. Tel Aviv has voted the most gay-friendly city in the world. But they must get a blank check, unconditional support from the church, and God is unconditionally required to support them no matter what. And yet the whole message of the Bible is God's blessings are conditional on obedience, and God's curses and judgments are what a man sows that shall he reap. So where is the logic that a person like Ted Cruz can say that we must support the state of Israel no matter what? We must support the IDF. We must support the government of Netanyahu. We must support a secular state no matter how LGBTQ friendly to perverts they are, no matter how many babies they murder of their own people through abortion, no matter what they do, no matter how they treat Christians in Gaza. And remember, there are hundreds of thousands of Christians in Gaza. And I think many people forget that there are hundreds of thousands of Arab Christians in the Middle East, and specifically in Palestine, in Gaza. And we shouldn't forget about them either. Of course, we care about the Jewish people, and we want them one to Christ, because Jesus is the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father except through him. And of course, we want to care for our brothers in Christ, who in many cases may be Arab Palestinians. And there are millions of Christians in Iran, too, that we should be caring about. So this mindlessness of the Ted Cruz's and the Israel Zionist lobby, both the Christian Zionist and the Jewish Zionist in America, who have this attitude that you must support the state of Israel no matter what, and any criticism of the secular state and their political actions is anti-Semitism, and it's unacceptable, and you can't even think about doing it, and so on, it doesn't make sense. Every single prophet of the Bible condemned both the Judeans and the northern kingdom of Israel for idolatry and immorality and interfaith and ingratitude. Do you really think that God's standards have so changed that he now is okay with perversion and idolatry and immorality and all the things that the prophets of the Old Testament condemned in the old Judah and the old state of Israel, which were a lot more God-honoring than what we see today. There are more prostitutes in Jerusalem than there are ministers of the gospel. And the abortion going on there, I had the head of the Israeli pro-life movement in our mission house telling us, we Jews have killed more of our babies than the Nazis did. And speaking about the abortion holocaust taking place in Israel at this time. Now, that's not even talking about what's been done with the Gazan Palestinians or with the people in Iran and these attacks, which the Americans called preemptive strikes, but which many others saw as a kind of like Pearl Harbor type sneak attack, secret attack, surprise attack, even tagged on to a time of negotiations and was seen as particularly treacherous because the Iranians were literally at the negotiation table seeking a political, peaceful solution to the Iranian nuclear facilities that they are building for energy and willing to make all kinds of concessions and promises and allowance international inspections to clarify the fact that they don't have nuclear weapons and don't have a plan for nuclear weapons, even though the head of American intelligence was saying there's no plan to have nuclear weapons in Iran. It was canceled back in 2003. And the International Nuclear Atomic Energy Commission has also come to conclusions Iran has no nuclear weapons and isn't planning to make any. So there was an argument over were there even nuclear weapons or was this just nuclear power plants for peaceful provision of electricity through nuclear plants. So interesting, we're dealing with irregular verbs. If people we don't like attack a country, it's unprovoked aggression, no matter how much provocation it was. And if we or our allies attack someone, it's always a preemptive strike. And they are violating international law by having a nuclear power plant, but we are not violating international law by having nuclear weapons. So there's a lot of inconsistency, hypocrisy, and double standards going on here. But I think people particularly need to remember that we're dealing with a situation which is of the West's making, particularly the United States, made the Iran of today, which if it's a rogue state, well, it's a state of the U.S. State Department's making. And we need to remember who were the real rogues here. When you look at the history of Iran, it's quite clear that they were pushed into this by the U.S. State Department back in 1979, and particularly Jimmy Carter must get the credit for having created the particular threat that is being condemned right now as a threat to world peace. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And I get really frustrated. I mean, I'm pleased you brought up the Ted Cruz situation because you and I both know that the Israel of the Bible is very different to the state of Israel today. And there are all sorts of indicators to it. But you might want to ask yourself why, if it's the same, do the Israel of today call themselves Israelis, whereas the Israel of the Bible called themselves Israelites? There is a key difference there, but there's a lot more to it than that. And when you can very easily get hold of copies of the Bible where Christ's words are written in red. These people who claim to be Christians clearly haven't read the words of Jesus Christ, because otherwise their beliefs would be very different. And I think that Jesus Christ would be, how can I put this, very disappointed to see the people that they do support when he made it clear in the Bible who these people were. But I would also throw in and the word Israel, because you touched on, I've got it written down exactly what you said here in the show post, how God's blessings are conditional through obedience. Well, Israel is made up of Ish, man, Ra, ruling, El, with God. So Israel is Israel, man ruling with God. Well, again, that's showing that man has to obey God's laws to be this Israel of the Bible. There is more to it than that. We've talked about it before, about the, you could look at the terminology of what Adam really means. If you get a strong concordance with the Aramaic and Hebrew dictionary, I believe Adam is word 119, and it's defined as who Adam is in that concordance. But we don't have the time to get into that today. Is there any other comments that you'd like to make on that? And then if you would like, you've been unavailable for the last few weeks, so if you would like to give us a rundown of what you've been up to, unless you want to save that for a whole other show, it's up to you, Peter.
Yes, thank you very much. And we do need to be very precise when we're quoting from the Bible. Remember, the Bible ends with the last verse in Revelation pronouncing a curse on anyone who takes away from the word of God or who adds to the word of God. We're not allowed to take anything away, or from us will be taken away the blessings mentioned in the book. And if we add anything to the Bible, then to us will be added the curses in the Bible. And those are very serious threats. So to add or to change or to subtract from the Bible is about as serious a crime as you can commit in a biblical sense. And yet there are people distorting scriptures. And to take a verse like Genesis 12, verse 1 to 3, and to insert the word Israel, you know, those who bless you, in brackets Israel, I will bless. It doesn't say Israel. It's a promise to Abraham and to the Messiah. Now, you are not blessed because of your political position or whether you support military strikes on Iran or not. That is not what the Bible is saying. It is quite clear, if you bless Christ, you will be blessed. If you curse Christ, you will be cursed. Our relationship with God through all eternity depends on our relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. He is the Messiah. He is the seed of Abraham. And so the blessing promise is not to a political entity, which at this moment happens to be very secular, pro-LGBTQ, pro-abortion, and pro a whole lot of other things, everything from legalized prostitution onwards. You cannot think the blessings of God rest upon any political state. Salvation is not by race. Salvation is by grace alone. And so people have made an idol out of either the Jewish people as general or on a political state, a secular state in the Middle East today that takes the name Israel, are really being biblically illiterate. It is mindless to have someone like Senator Ted Cruz say, my main reason for supporting Israel, and in this case supporting bombing of Iran, is because the Bible commands me to do it. Well, where does the Bible command you to do it? To think that a non-religious leader, a non-theologian like Tucker Carlson, could ask the kind of tough questions which every minister should be asking when people come out with us. I've been editing for Christian magazines where I had to cross these things out, where people inserting the names Israel in where this Bible text doesn't say it. You don't need to change the Bible. You may not change the Bible. If you need to twist scripture, insert or change things, or ignore what the New Testament says in interpreting those Old Testament verses, then your position is false. And Christians need to respect the Bible enough to let it speak for itself. And this twisting of scriptures is unacceptable. And to think that it could get you into a world war, literally create nuclear holocaust, where millions are going to die because of bad eschatology and bad exegesis and poor hermeneutics, that is very serious. There are rules as to how you interpret the scripture. You've got to adhere to these principles. You cannot make the scripture say what it isn't saying. And if it's not in context with the rest of scripture, it's not valid. So this is a serious matter, and we've just seen, we've skirted the edge of a serious escalation of war, which could have gone nuclear very easily. And I'm hoping and praying that this promise of ceasefire between Israel and Iran is true and will be sustained. Although some of the newspaper headlines you read just before this program put that into doubt, that there's already claimed that there's been a violation of the ceasefire. Well, that's not very promising. But we don't know what tomorrow holds just yet. What we do know is that blessed are the peacemakers. They shall be called children of God. We should not be picking a war. And I also think America shouldn't be getting involved in a war that some other country started. The American government that is in there right now was elected by a huge margin on the basis of a promise of no more useless wars, no more foreign wars, no more Middle Eastern wars, no more forever wars. And that resonated with many millions of voters. And I know just on my speaking tour around America, and I've just been over in Indiana, in Pennsylvania, in Washington, D.C., in Florida, and in Georgia, and all over the United States, I could see the consternation of many conservative people, homeschoolers, pastors, different leaders, that America seems to be getting sucked into a war in the Middle East. And so many had the attitude of, if Israel wants to pick a fight with Iran, let it be their fight. It's not our fight. We should not get involved in it. America first was the policy we supported. And there's this attitude of, we are not there as an agent to Israel's foreign policy. If Israel wants to pick a fight that they can't finish, they shouldn't have picked that fight. They need to negotiate an end to this before anyone else dies. But America mustn't feel that they've been somehow made a hostage, that they are forced to get involved just to bring Israel out from the consequence of their own actions. It's not wise, it's not morally defensible to have a surprise attack and, you know, call a preemptive strike later. There's a lot of people not even convinced that there are nuclear weapons in Iran or that there are nuclear weapons being prepared. So there's something's been questioned. And if the nuclear authorities and the American intelligence community are saying there are none, then maybe they're correct. Maybe we should not be picking a fight or risking an escalating war, which could easily pull in more nuclear powers. Also, people saying, if it's wrong to have nuclear weapons in the Middle East, then why is Israel allowed to have some? Why don't they offer, we will get rid of all our nuclear weapons in exchange for a promise that no other country in the Middle East will keep nuclear weapons? But it's a little bit two-faced. If you say you can't have nuclear weapons, but we can. And so everyone believes that Israel's got at least 200 nuclear warheads. And this is a open secret. Israel neither confirms nor denies it, but it's pretty well known from many different sides that Israel's got nuclear weapons. And by the way, this brings up another key factor of the Kennedy files, because there are those who claim that John F. Kennedy, the American president who was assassinated brutally in 1963, was getting very serious with the state of Israel over their nuclear tests, and that they obviously had a nuclear program, and he didn't want them to have nuclear bombs and wanted them to relinquish him. And it's very coincidental that he got assassinated shortly after he started to make a strong stand against the state of Israel for having nuclear weapons. And LBJ was seen to be very compromised in that he didn't challenge Israel's having nuclear weapons, but John F. Kennedy was adamant that they should not have them. And that just needs to be added to the mix of why have the John F. Kennedy files not been fully released yet? And there were people I spoke to in America, including on the military side, who said, this is the reason. It would embarrass the American ally, the state of Israel, in the Middle East if those details came out. So that's just another item. So thank you, Andrew. Back to you.
Thank you, Peter. And that also reminds me of Lyndon Baines Johnson with the attack on the USS Liberty. He did absolutely nothing to condemn that. And there were reports that it was because he didn't want to embarrass an ally. Very similar how things seem to have, you know, not changed a great deal in these, you know, years since that, nearly 60 years since that event happened. And of course, there are other people talking about the USS Nimitz being conveniently over there at the moment, one of the biggest American ships, which is incidentally due for decommissioning next year. So there have been, as you can imagine, in the independent and alternative media, all sorts of speculation as to whether that could be hit in a false flag, because they need to get rid of it anyway to go to a wider war. I think now already the fact that America struck Iran at the weekend, they didn't need any further provocation. So we had an attack on a US barracks yesterday in Qatar, I believe, in which the Americans were warned beforehand so they could get their people out. So my very suspicious nature comes in here, where I believe that, you know, are all these things just grand theatre and all these people actually being controlled? It is possible, but it's also possible that we are seeing, you know, something that's really going on. Only you, the audience member, can make your own choice on that. I'm extremely conspiratorial. I feel I was listening to someone at the weekend. I was listening to Mark Collett interviewing Mike Enoch on his Sunday night show on Odyssey.com. That's his channel. And he made they sort of talked about people who say, oh, well, that you know, they're very smug in the sense that all you're seeing is theatre and all sides are controlled. And they felt that was, you know, these people just trying to appear that they knew more than other people when they didn't really. I can understand why they would believe that. But I feel things like Trump 2016 and Brexit of the same year, these were kind of things that threw many of us who've been studying what goes on from a conspiratorial point of view for many years kind of off the scent. It was like, oh, we've suddenly, maybe all the work we put out there, people are waking up, and that's why we got Brexit and that's why we got Trump in. But when you see it further down the line, Brexit has resulted in absolutely no visible changes we can see. Certainly what we voted for, we've got more of. Okay, and when you look at Trump, the promises were great, but how many of them were actually delivered? And so I wish that I'd have just stayed the course, which was, for me, it's always been the synagogue of Satan, and that is who we're told it is, and we know who these people are, and they don't have to be of a certain ethnicity, but they have to be of a mindset that joins together with a certain belief that Jesus Christ talks about, and of course coins the term in Revelation 2:9 and 3:9. And they were, from my point of view, originally established in 1776 with Adam Weishaupt and the Order of the Illuminati, which was to corrupt people in high places, get them on board. And they've got to such a situation today that all the people in all the governments throughout the world that they need are part of the synagogue of Satan. That is my opinion. I may well be wrong. Are there any comment? And again, we know we're going to get there because that's what it says in the Bible, but my opinion may be wrong because my timeline might be out. It might be not quite there yet, but it'll be there in 50 or 100 years. Is this anything you'd like to speculate on, Peter, before we go?
Yes, I think I should notice that it's interesting how often sinking of a ship has been a false flag that's gotten Americans a major war. So going back to 1898 and the Remember the Maine, the Spanish-American War began with an American battleship in Havana Harbor blowing up. And while subsequent evidence was that it was an internal explosion, the newspapers at the time said, you know, probably by a torpedo, and they blamed the Spanish, and this launched the war that America wanted and was pre-positioned for, to take the Philippines, to take Cuba, to take Puerto Rico and a whole lot of other places and sink the Spanish Navy in the Pacific Ocean. And it all started with the USS Maine being sunk, even though it was an own goal false flag. So remember the Maine? And then there was the Lusitania, which was meant to be a passenger ship, but it was shipping vast quantities of weaponry and munitions, artillery shells and explosives across, which is why a single torpedo sank the ship because of the secondary internal explosion. Then you've got the USS Maddox. The Vietnam War started with at the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which, while the Maddox didn't sink, it was damaged, they said. And they claimed that some torpedo boats from Vietnam attacked an American battle fleet, which must be either stupidest or the bravest thing ever done by any naval personnel, for a little torpedo boat to attack a aircraft carrier and a massive a battle fleet, a strike fleet. But that was later admitted was a false flag, never happened. But it was the pretext for America getting involved in a ruinous and extremely expensive Vietnam War. So the USS Nimitz may have been pre-positioned from the Pacific into the Arabian Gulf to be sunk in a false flag attack, which could be blamed on Iran, because it wouldn't be the most expensive loss. It's a 50-year-old aircraft carrier scheduled for decommissioning next year anyway. So the USS Nimitz being moved to the Arabian Gulf, some people who've seen how ships sinking or attacks have been used as false flags to justify a ruinous and expensive wars in the past might have been pre-positioned for that. So I understand why somebody's antennas would be rotating and pricking up on this, because that is the way it's often done, pretext and false flags. One cannot trust the mainstream media, for sure, we know that. We don't trust the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, the Clinton News Network, the Sunday Slime, the Slime Magazine, Newspeak, Useless News and World Report, any of these other examples of Ministry of Truth or mini-truth, as George Orwell called it. Now, George Orwell understood how this works. He had been a propagandist for the British in the Second World War. He had once been a communist himself and a policeman. So he noticed the prophetic book 1984 is set in London, and the protagonist is Winston Smith. And I think when I first read 1984, which was a Sedgwick book at school in Rhodesia, I thought it was talking about the Soviet Union. But it took me a while to realize, but it's based in Britain, it's based in London. And in fact, George Orwell even said he modeled mini-truth or the Ministry of Truth on the BBC. And you know, there's someone who had been a propagandist and a communist before, and he's warning us. And today it looks like 1984 has been used as a manual by our governments rather than as a warning. And so, as they said, even in 1984 book, they didn't even know if these battles took place. They didn't even know if the dates were correct. Everything was so fraudulent. It was like manufacturing propaganda out of thin air. In many cases, there's no relationship to reality. They didn't even know if the attacks or battles that were reported between the different belligerent forces around the world even happened. And so when you get to that stage, I think we're there already, where you don't even know how much of what they're talking about is real. We don't even know if nuclear sites were hit. They said it was totally successful, totally obliterated, although pictures from Google Earth don't seem to confirm that yet. And then there's others saying, but all of the nuclear material was shifted to other locations before the bombing. There could be some theater. I must admit, it's not like both sides aren't involved in the lies. While I was traveling around America now, I met with a lot of interesting people. And just amongst other things, I was in Florida, just down the road from Cape Canaveral, and I was staying in a family where the man of the house was a NASA technician. And So I just thought I'd say to him, do you believe the moon landings were real? And he said, I don't know. Now, this man works at NASA. He says, the fact that they lost all of the technology and are saying they're unable to go back to the moon is suspicious. He said, what's even more suspicious is all of the photographs and videos were accidentally deleted, all of them. I mean, there's so much suspicions. So there's someone working in NASA who is suspicious of whether we even went to the moon. And then, you know, I was speaking about a range of different things with people, some of whom had been in the military, some of whom had been in politics, and they don't even know what is real or not about what we're hearing about from the Middle East. And, you know, if this target's destroyed or hit, and there was this suspicion, and these are not major conspiracy theory people. These are just normal folks in the scheme of things who, when asked a straight question, couldn't give a straight answer because they said they do not know. They know that the powers that be have lied so often, it's very hard to know when to take them seriously. And the masquerade madness, the lockdown lunacy, the salvation by vaccination COVID cult is just one case in point. But we've had governments lying to us before. And so even when we're getting panicky about, we could be at the brink of a new world war and nuclear holocaust and could start exchanging missiles, even that could be absolute fraud. Some of the people I'm speaking to on the ground don't even think these are real scenarios, but just think they're used there to terrify, disorientate, and distract the population. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And before we go, something that I just found out recently, okay? I never knew this. Well, let me just tell you what I typed into Google because I found it out recently. Enoch Powell brought West Indian nurses into UK. That's my search term in google.com. Comes back with AI overview. Yes, Enoch Powell, as health minister from 1960 to 1963, actively recruited nurses from the Caribbean to work in the UK's National Health Service, the NHS. This recruitment drive was part of a broader effort to address staffing shortages in the NHS following World War II. Powell's actions, however, were later criticised in light of his controversial Rivers of Blood speech in 1968, which opposed further immigration. Well, when you see something like that, you think, why would somebody's position change so quickly? Well, what if it didn't? What if that was his role in from 1960 to 63? And then he was the one that they chose to make this speech that was had some very inflammatory language in it. And it gave Edward Heath, who was the Conservative Party leader at the time, they weren't in government, although he would be elected. The speech took place in 68. Heath was elected in 70. He fired Enoch Powell the very next day and said there is no place for, I'm paraphrasing, for these sort of views in the Conservative Party. So that's, you know, over 50 years ago. And can you see how that might have been an event that took place in order to demonstrate what policies would be accepted and what wouldn't, how they were starting to ring fence things and what have you. Don't forget that the Race Relations Act came in 1965, not just in the UK, but it was the Hart-Celler Act in the United States. I don't know the names of the acts, but they were similar in both Australia and Canada in 1965. So it might appear a bit irrelevant, but my point is that even the things that you think that you know, even the people you think that you know from history, you can still be learning other things and your whole opinion can change. So, Peter, any final comment before we go?
Yes, there's a lot of warnings in the Bible against being deceived. We should not be deceived. And so the very fact that we're warned not to be deceived shows that it's possible even for a child of God to be deceived. Let's not trust what we see around us as much as we trust what's written in the Bible. We need to get back to the Scripture. The Scripture is the gold standard of truth. In John chapter 8, which you've referenced several times, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And that's what this program begins with. Because it's such a pivotal verse from such a pivotal chapter and book in the Bible, we need to know the truth. And I would encourage all our listeners to read the Gospel of John again in full. And not only that, if people would like a report, because I didn't really give one on my recent mission to America, it's on our Frontline website, frontlinemissionsa.org, frontlinemissionsa.org. You'll see reports on that and a whole lot of other things, including a presentation I did on the Iran war and the war between Israel and Iran last Thursday night at the Reformation Society. We've often got audio visuals of these presentations, and that's all available on under the audio visual on our frontlinemissionsa.org website. We've also got a On the Frontline YouTube page where you'll see a lot of the presentations I gave in America at different venues, different congregations and special meetings, which, again, our listeners might find interesting. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And I forgot to ask your email address, how they can, you gave the website, so how they can contact you, and if you want to mention your Facebook as well.
Yes, so you will find Peter Hammond and Frontline Fellowship Literature for Africa on Facebook. And my personal email address is peter@frontline.org.za. peter@frontline.org.za. Thank you, Andrew. God bless.
Thank you, Peter. God bless you also. And I'll just throw in here, I haven't mentioned this before, like my website, achshow.com, Peter also has a subscribe box on his Frontline Fellowship website. I knew where Peter was the last few weeks, but I didn't know if it was something that I could share. I never actually asked Peter, but then I started getting emails coming in because I subscribed to the Frontline Fellowship website. So it gave me details of where Peter was speaking. He spoke to like an Amish community. I believe they were Mennonites. Is that correct, Peter?
Actually, German Brethren, old German Brethren, who are very similar to them, though. Fascinating, my first exposure to that community. And yes, I thought some of those pictures and details would be fascinating to people to see communities, they're separatists, but how they've got healthy, happy children, strong communities. They don't live with fences and huge amounts of barbed wire and walls around them like we do in South Africa. So it was quite unique to me to see such peaceful, happy and healthy people. They don't take vaccines. They don't have the same health issues many of us have. And, of course, all their food's very organic because they don't live with poisons and hormones and all the other things that we get pumped full of. So I found that community quite refreshing and enlightening.
Yes, and that's one of the stories you can find on the Frontline Fellowship website. And also, don't forget, there's a Give, Send, Go page. Please support Peter's work. And that being said, I'm going to close out the show. I want to thank Peter so much for joining us today for a presentation entitled The Real Story Behind the War Between Israel and Iran. Peter and I will be back with you again next Tuesday. I'll be back with you all on Saturday, if not before. And until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful week, and bye for now.